Hello, everyone, and welcome to Book Spider, a Book of the Week format podcast where we try very hard to say insightful things about literature and really don't try that hard at anything else at all. This week, we are discussing Couples, the 1968 novel which made John Updike a literary sensation and landed him on the cover of Time magazine. Couples follows several couples, as you would imagine from the title, in the small New England town of Tarbox in 1963 and 1964, as they experiment with various configurations of sexual liberation in various levels of transparency, sometimes edging closer to something we might now call polyamory or swinging, but never really quite leaving the framework of mere adultery. Our greatest focus in the novel is on the contractor Pete Hanema, who has an affair with a woman named Foxy Whitman and procures what is then an illegal abortion following her pregnancy, which requires him to convince his wife to sleep with her dentist for convoluted reasons that I don't know if I'm going to go into in great detail here. My choice of this novel was spurred not exactly by the recent publication of Selected Letters of John Updike, but by several pieces I read connected to that publication, which asserted that Updike has fallen greatly out of favor relative to the acclaim and esteem that he had in the first couple decades of his career among younger readers, younger here being defined as anyone younger than a baby boomer, which is to say, at this point, most people. So if that's the case, if it's the case that Updike is no longer of interest or esteem to most literary readers, then that's not a new state of affairs, right? The three of us all went through an MA and MFA program together. And to my recollection, we did not read Updike, nor did we encounter anyone who professed to be an Updike fan that I can recall. And I don't remember hearing him referred to at all, either in formal or informal contexts in our combined literature and creative writing master's program. If there's anything I'm forgetting, you two are welcome to correct me. I know that A&P is sometimes, I think A&P might have been in some of the anthologies that we were using to teach 200 level classes or 100 level classes, but A&P is, I think, in some ways, like, not totally typical of standard Updike. And anyway, it's just, you know, one story relative to a really pretty imposing body of work. But anyway, you know, I remember having a conversation with someone we knew in grad school where she asked me what I'd been reading. And at the time, I actually happened to be reading Updike's Rabbit novels. I'd found them in a collected volume at a used bookstore and bought that for a long bus trip. And so I said, oh, yeah, I've been reading the Rabbit novels by Updike. And she laughed in kind of an incredulous and somewhat derogatory way, as though I had told her I was reading Tom Clancy or something like that.
Who was it?
I'll text you later.
I just want to know who it is. But go on.
Well, if because of what I'm about to say, I will text
the
you
last
later.
Paragraph.
Probably
in
more
this
polite
intro.
To leave this person. Yeah, probably more polite to leave this person anonymous. But you know, I had this interaction where I was kind of snickered at condescendingly for reading Updike, and it kind of annoyed me because I did enjoy the Rabbit novels, though not so much so that I read more Updike after that or thought much about Updike until Collected Letters came out, and there was a spate of think pieces about his falling from esteem. But thinking about it now, it occurs to me that the person who laughed at the reading of Updike was herself an Updike character, right? Like all the people who populate this novel, at least, she was exceptionally, perhaps even unrealistically intelligent and articulate and cultured, and also behaved in a mildly sociopathic way in the realm of sex and romance because she was driven by impulses and desires that she didn't seem totally interested in questioning or mastering. So, I don't know. I'm not sure what to make of all that, except that I wanted to read and discuss this overlooked once great literary hero and just kind of talk a little bit about how he's aged, particularly. I don't know if this is the best Updike novel in common understanding, but it's certainly kind of the one that is the most fully his sort of thing, you know? as I understand it. And so I guess the first question, had either of you encountered Updike before? And, you know, how did you feel about couples, either relative to those previous encounters or coming as a new reader to his work?
It's entirely new for me. I have not read Updike before. It definitely feels like having read couples that I think that there were authors I would have dropped in favor of talking about Updike. I think his prose is painterly and lovely, and I genuinely see value in studying the craft and that he's applying, and the like thoughtfulness and the playfulness and the sexiness and all of these things are far more interesting than several other authors I can remember thinking far less of. And at the same time, I kind of found the story, the kind of I guess like central sort of concept of the book to be kind of tired, at least maybe from our like time looking back. It does feel like it belongs in that time and maybe is justified, you know, even though I came away feeling a little bit resentful spending so much time with these people who I just didn't find the stakes to be that interesting and to be kind of reflective of a time of being extraordinarily divorced from things of real meaning or like real problems in the world. And I don't usually feel that way about books, but for whatever reason, I felt it about this one. I did deeply admire the incredible, painterly. I don't know if that's the right word, but the writing is gorgeous, and I loved moment by moment, and at the end felt, you know, kind of just a little cool toward what that prose was conveying.
I think, in contrast, I think that I liked this novel. I think it's good. It's funny, at work, I have a coworker. Well, she moved to a different station. But I have a coworker. She is a black woman named Bumi. And she told me that she has started to read Gone with the Wind at the suggestion of another coworker that we have named Megan. And I was like, I do not want to read Gone with the Wind. That sounds like a horrible, racist piece of garbage novel. And she's like, you know, I'm listening to it while I'm working, and I'm just in awe of the wonderful prose. And I'm like, really? And she's like, but you're right. It is deeply racist. And we kind of chuckled, right? And like, I think this novel has some casual prejudice that ages it, that makes it less timeless than the quality of the prose could make it, you know, because I agree. I think it's painterly. I think it's I think it's really quite lovely, like the range of euphemisms he can employ for, you know, sex acts, and how, you know, really, really nice purple euphemisms.
Yeah.
So like it, you know, I think just on the sentence level, it was nice reading that. And to be honest, it really did spark that, that part of me that really loves a novel with like some interesting themes. And it's like, it made me think about a lot of stuff. Like, you know, like for example, they're in a community called Tarbox. So imagine a box full of a sticky substance that you can sink into and not get out of, and then you drown and then you're preserved. And like the whole like tar box of all these people fucking each other and like coming away with hurt feelings and coming away with, you know, feelings of inadequacy or whatnot seemed like a cool idea to me. So like I think that there is a lot to like about this novel, and to my mind what holds it back is the fact that it's dated.
The question of datedness is an interesting one, I think, right? Because it is, you know, there are things that are dated in effective ways and things that are dated in ways, I think, that just kind of distance the reader. You know, you mentioned race. I mean, I think like the question of race is an interesting one here because there are really only a couple of non-white characters and they are generally very peripheral to the story. But there's a way, there is kind of like a just sort of a casual dehumanization in the way that the viewpoint characters think about, in one case, I think a black backhoe operator,
operator, a maintenance guy, or something.
And in another case, I think the way that the speech of an Asian man who's I think dying of cancer, if I remember right, or dying of some illness.
And don't forget that I definitely think there's some like on the edge anti-Semitic descriptions.
Sure, sure. I think the obvious defense of that is probably that those are accurate reflections of how those individuals would have experienced those people, right? Mm. And I think ultimately, like I do think that's true, right? I mean, I have no idea how Updike as an individual would have felt. He was generally regarded as a pretty liberal person over the course of his life, right? But there's a way in which I think that, you know, even though the characters do in some sense, I guess, suffer for their sins, there's a way in which this novel is just deeply, deeply uninterested in saying what is right or advancing the idea of rightness or being on the right side of anything ideologically. It's just this, and I think maybe more than anything, that's aesthetically what kind of dates it to us now, right? Like it's this particular combination of just vividly beautiful, wonderful writing. Just every paragraph is marvelously, marvelously written in the service of an approach to fiction that feels really remarkably cold and amoral, right?
Right.
And I can't really think of anything else. You know, you could maybe compare that to Nabokov in certain ways, but I think Nabokov actually is a deeply moral writer below a certain level of irony, right? And like Nabokov is the only other writer I can think of I've encountered recently who's so skilled at a sentence level and so where you read it and you're just so kind of taken away with the infinite beauty of language that you just want to go immediately write, you know? But I think with Nabokov, you have this very conscious kind of ironic distance between these dreadful people who are narrating the story and the kind of idea that we're supposed to have of them as the judgment that is like one thin level of irony below that character. And with this, yeah, I mean, there's a way that I think like the feelings and perceptions and observations and thoughts of the characters are, they feel human, they feel real, they feel authentic, but there's just so little interest in really kind of passing any kind of judgment or making any prescription or it feels fundamentally amoral in a way that is totally alien, I think, now in a world where, you know, the ethical stance of fiction, right? Or the idea of like, well, this novel is here to present this marginalized viewpoint, or, you know, this novel is about why, you know, capitalism is bad, right? Like that lens is so central to how we conceptualize fiction as both readers and writers, right? And I don't even know, you know, like the common charge you hear against Updike is that he's sexist. And I don't really know if I would call this novel sexist, or at least not sexist in a way that, I don't know, like, I mean, I normally, when I think about sexism in fiction, the first thing my mind goes to is female characters, women characters, not having the kind of range and depth and realism that men characters have, right? Men get to be kind of fully developed individuals and women are types, right? When I think about things I encounter in fiction that I think of as sexist, that's often the first place my mind goes. And maybe your senses were different, but I did feel like the men and women characters both had like equally rich subjectivities. We do spend more time in a man's point of view because Pete is our protagonist, but it didn't feel to me as though the women were like underwritten or underdeveloped relative to the men, leaving aside the kind of asymmetry again around having a male protagonist.
I actually thought like Foxy and Angela and I thought Foxy and Angela were more sympathetic characters than Pete.
Yeah, and if it's sexist, it's probably sexist in the same way that it's racist, where I think like the authentic perceptions of the viewpoint characters are so inextricable from, it's like you can't really step outside it and kind of see like, there's no gap between like the expectation of how we judge the characters and who they are, right? Which is at least that I was able to detect. I don't know, maybe it's oversimplifying to say that, but.
Yeah, that ironic distance that you, like, if you are portraying a racist character or a sexist character in your work, you have to have some kind of ironic distance to show the reader that, hey, this, I'm critiquing this racism, I'm critiquing this sexism. And I'm, you know, like you said, Updike's not doing that here. There's no clear alternate perspective that would tell us, well, you know, because it's 1968, I have to describe these characters as they would be. But, you know, there's nothing like that.
And I suppose that's not even a question of like how things, it's not just 1968 versus 2026, right? Like I think about East of Eden, right? Like you have an Asian American character in East of Eden who, when he first appears in the novel, is kind of speaking in this awkward pidgin and then kind of goes, actually, I just do that to throw off the racists. And then, you know, becomes this very like textured character in a way that is like clearly a reaction to what you would expect that character to be. Right. Like, I can't remember the character's name, but you guys who remember, you remember who I mean, right?
From East of Eden. The Chinese guy in East.
The Chinese guy from East of Eden. Right. And I think, I can't remember what year East of Eden came out, but it was probably earlier than this, I think. Yeah, like Steinbeck there is like writing a minority character in a way that is very interested in critiquing the perceptions of that, like the way that people would react to him racially. And like the way that Steinbeck handles that character actually feels much more contemporary than how, you know, the Ongs are handled in Couples, even though Couples was 10 years later. You mentioned, Patrick, that you found Foxy and Angela more sympathetic than Pete, and I think I would agree with that, you know, and they're both kind of, I think, they're both characters who could be, you can imagine a version of them that's much more one-dimensional, much less sympathetic, much more kind of, in Angela's case, more sort of stereotypically shrewish, right? And you know, to Updike's credit, he avoids that. Did you feel like Pete was a good protagonist, classically speaking?
I thought he was interesting. You know, that question, does Pete grow or learn? He definitely grows, like his situation changes, right? At the beginning of the novel, he's married to Angela, carrying on a couple different affairs with Foxy, with Georgine, and then later with B. And then at the end, you know, there's the whole abortion thing, and Ken's like, we're getting a divorce, blah, blah, blah. Ken divorces Foxy, and then Foxy and Pete get married. So after Pete divorces Angela. So there is change there's this change in his situation, but I don't like he. One thing that he thinks is that whenever he's having sex with a woman, he's in love with her. You know, he falls in love with her, and what I find interesting about that is, like, this isn't like today. That wouldn't necessarily be a character flaw. You would just kind of seek out an open relationship, right? If you're someone like Pete, whereas the idea of an open relationship wouldn't really be acceptable in the 60s. And I wonder if, I assume that he will continue, like if the story goes on, he's going to continue with extramarital affairs. So he hasn't changed in that way, I wouldn't say. But has he... Like, is that something that we're kind of meant to think about? Like, you know, are we meant to think about, like, somehow he is getting out of the tar box because he marries Foxy, who might be a different type of spouse? I'm not quite sure.
I don't, yeah, the way that you said it, or you said... I don't know if you said this in the way that I would say it, but I kind of feel like things have changed for him. I don't know if he's changed. Like, I think that there's space that's created, because he's alone. Being alone now, some of my favorite passages in the novel are from the very end, when he is just kind of on his own, occasionally running into women and being like, "I loved you," and he's just been kind of like exiled,
right?
And those passages are really Updike fucking kind of blowing shit out of the water with amazing writing. But I don't know. I thought about like Unbearable Lightness of Being, like Tomas at the end, is sort of, his ability to pursue and to be, you know, the sexual Lothario that he's been in, you know, through the rest of the story is sort of, he just doesn't have it anymore. And so his, I don't remember her name, the woman that he ends up with, is, sort of finally able to like keep him. And I don't know. I kind of feel like I got less information about, Tomas. We only get kind of a little bit at the very end. We only get a little bit at the very end here too. And, there's something, you know, Foxy's a real horn dog, so maybe she'll keep him busy, you know? And, so like,
and she does say things like there are hints that she's like a competitive person, and that might factor into like whether or not she's able to tie him down.
She's definitely going to be a lot more present than Angela in like managing and being aware of Pete's like predilections. So, I don't know. Like, I think, you know, I think that it's really is maybe enough for the story for Pete to have so much space created to be reflective. And that I think is earned and Updike makes very good use of it. Hans, when you asked this, did you see him as changing?
Well, I wasn't sure. I mean, I think that's the question of both the before and the after of Pete as a character, right? The psychology of Pete. You know, another thing that I think is aesthetically I don't even want to say dated about this exactly, because I don't regard this as bad, but I think it's different from a lot of the expectations for what you would see in literary fiction in 2026. The first thing we learn about Pete is that he was orphaned as a college student, right? I don't know if you can be orphaned as an adult, but that both his parents died when he was in college. And there is a very poignant scene where, pretty early in the novel, like one of the moments that I just most thought, oh, this should not leave the canon, right? Like this is a great work that needs to be remembered and revisited. When the hamster dies and he's thinking about the dead hamster and then thinking about the bird that died in the yard, and I just thought that was marvelous, right? But the whole question of like, okay, he had this tragedy that has made him in some ways a more sensitive person, but he's also this kind of adulterous lecher and to some extent, like not considerate the way he should be of the people in his family. I think it would be very hard for a modern novelist to resist tying those things together in a causal chain somewhat more neatly, right? Making it clear like he does A because B and that results in C, right? And I think here, you know, you have the pieces, but the question of how they really fit together or what causes what is to some extent left up to the reader, right? And I think there is an effect, for better or worse, where you can get so drowned in, I don't mean drowned in a bad way, right? But you can get so drowned in beautiful prose that kind of the prosaic question of, well, why does this person do what he does, gets lost fairly. Maybe in the way that, like, the ways that the question of why we do what we do day to day is lost also, right? You know, and I mean, Updike is writing in a time where at least I have the sense that maybe people were less introspective than they are now, right? You know, and so that extends then to the question of what happens after this, right? We are given some ambiguity and some pieces we can put together on our own about how the things before this feed into the behavior we see when it starts, and equally left somewhat on our own about how the experiences that he has had may or may not have changed him. I think my instinctive reaction upon finishing it was to assume that some cycle had just continued. Something had perpetuated itself and we were beginning, you know, it reminded me a bit of, I guess, I don't know, like sometimes it made me think a little of Mad Men, right? To like connect to something from another time period, but in a different medium, where you have this central character who is in this constant battle between learning and growing and kind of sliding back into these old ways of being. And it's never really clear how much he's moving forward versus in a circle, right? And a moment's decision might change whether the whole last 10 years of our life have been a line or a circle, you know? And my instinct was to think that it ends on a circle, but in some way, you know, you never ultimately repeat the same experience twice. So I don't know. And I like that ambiguity about it, right? I like that. I mean, again, like when I read so much contemporary fiction, the psychologies and the causations and the, you know, why this person does that, those things are also signposted just as the kind of ethical, like proper ethical framework is signposted. And there's something so alien about reading something that clearly has enormous, enormous, enormous aspirations to literary merit and yet is so kind of freed of those concerns, but alienating at the same time too, right? You know, I think there was a way that I both adored and felt alienated from this book. And I a lot of it, I think, is from the just remarkable extent to which it, while being beautiful and in some ways incredibly psychologically deep and complicated, is simultaneously just kind of uninterested truly in telling me what to think or really why people do what they do.
What about something that I was, another thing I was going to say about what makes it feel dated that seems important to bring up here, because you're asking about, you know, you're saying like the novel doesn't offer much in the way of like a causal explanation of why characters do what they do. But there is, it seems like Freudian ideas about psychology do underlie some of the character motivations. You know, I think Freddie, well, in the scene where Freddie and Angela are in bed and he can't really seem to get excited enough, he posits that he's gay and he's latently homosexual or whatever, and then says, you know, there are these two other characters, they're actually gay, but they can't have sex with each other, so they're having sex with each other's wives. So there was definitely some Freudian stuff going on, and I don't necessarily think that illuminates anything about why characters are doing what they're doing. But did that like register to you guys?
I think it does, because, you know, it feels like this is like the theological framework of morality is like absent, and whether or not, you know, Freud is, I don't think Freud appears anywhere. Did Freud come up anywhere in the text?
Well, there are discussions about analysis and characters being an analysis.
And an analysis would, in this context, would definitely be psychoanalysis, which is a specific Freudian thing.
So I guess, you know, it feels like in the absence of the you know, sort of religious framework, that is definitely, maybe even, you know, not diegetic, but maybe actually like, somewhat conscious in, you know, in the characters themselves, not just like Updike. And, so I think that it makes sense, for Freud to be, for that, just any kind of framework in absence of the traditional ones to tell these people, you know, what to do and how to behave.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I'll be honest, I'm not familiar enough with like Freudian theory to speak to it off the top of my head, right? I know, Patrick, in the past, like, you've applied it to other things that we've read pretty successfully.
Well, I just hate it.
You know it well because you hate it, and I just sort of contemptuously dismiss it.
Because I think it's bullshit.
Which is, like, not, you know, it's one of those things where, like, you probably should know it even if you dismiss it, right?
Right,
like,
right.
You should probably understand Marx whether or not you agree with or like Marx, and because it is so influential, especially, I mean, most of my favorite literature is from a period when it was somewhat more ascendant, right? And there's aspects of Freud in a lot of that have informed a lot of what I love, I'm sure.
Right, yeah. But following the idea that, like, I guess this novel isn't really doing like the thing that Lolita does, which is, you know, have this distance from this awful pedophile guy, while at the same time, you know, doing some stunning sentence level stuff. The Freudian stuff in this novel is also ambiguous. Like, despite it being there, I still think I agree with you, Hans, in that we don't necessarily get any like A, B to C chain of why one character does one thing or another. Which kind of, you know, like you said, like the ambiguity at the ending makes it more interesting. So, yeah.
And these might all be things that to some extent I might feel differently about on a reread, I should say, right? Like, although it doesn't seem, you know, there's certain novels where you know, okay, if I go through this knowing what's going to happen, it'll change, you know, this will be kind of a clue and this will illuminate that. And I don't intuitively necessarily feel like that's the truth here, right? I mean, to some extent, like, you know, maybe yet another thing that feels very mid-60s about it is that some of these urges are to some extent just taken somewhat for granted, right? Like, all men wish to fuck a lot.
Right.
And, you know, like, that's just kind of like a baseline assumption in the same way that if you drop a thing, it will fall, you know? And you don't necessarily need to explain things. You don't need to explain motivation much beyond that, because it's just sort of a baseline fact of humanity. And I mean, I'm like that. I'm obviously, that's not a thing that I believe, right? Like, it is often true, but not universally in the way it would be taken for granted here, you know? Huh. Well,
I was just going to read actually, like one of my favorite passages, if that's
absolutely
all right.
Please.
This is from that, you know, Pete is exiled from his, you know, French circle and separated from Angela and let's see where to start here. The tide was very low, and walking on the unscarred ribs of its recent retreat, Pete received, diagnosed as if the sustained roaring were a symptom within him, that violent waves were breaking on the sandbar a half mile away, and though little of their motion survived, their blended sound traveled to him upon the tranced water as if upon the taut skin of a drum. This effect, contrived with energies that could power cities, was his alone to witness. The great syllable around him seemed his own note, sustained since his birth, elicited from him now and given to the air that day was warm and smelled of ashes. It's just all fucking beautiful.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's a lot that passage is like the idea of a sound being carried on the ocean, like it's carried on the skin of a drum. And then, you know, that's pretty fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I read the one I was talking about?
Yeah,
as we're doing this. I mean, cause the language is so much of, I guess.
No, screw you. Book, right? Let's end the podcast.
In the nearly 5 years they had lived here, a small cemetery had accumulated along this edge of woods. Injured birds they had vainly nursed, dime store turtles that had softened and whitened and died, a kitten slammed in a screen door, a chipmunk torn from throat to belly by some inconclusive predator who had left a spark of life to flicker all one long June afternoon. Last autumn, when the robins were migrating, Nancy had found one with a broken back by the barn, groveling on the asphalt basketball court in its desire to fly, to join the others. Lifted sheerly by the beating of its heart, it propelled itself to the middle of the lawn, where the four Hanumas gathered in expectation of seeing it take wing, healed. But the bird was unhinged, as Pete's own father, with his shattered chest and spine, would have been unhinged had his lungs let him live. And the children, bored by the bird's poor attempt to become a miracle, wandered away. So only Pete, standing helpless as if beside a party guest who refused to leave, witnessed the final effort, an asymmetric splaying of the dusty wings and a heave that drove the robin's beak straight down into the sweetish, shadowy grass. The bird emitted a minute high cry, a point of noise as small as a star, and relaxed. Only Pete had heard this utterance. Only Pete, as now, attended the burial. And that one bit, you know, that does so much, I think, to give us the patience to stay with this character who is sort of an asshole for an enormous amount of the novel.
right.
It's really interesting that you mentioned Mad Men, because I was describing the novel to a friend earlier today, and he's like, that sounds like Mad Men. And I, you know, I was like, okay, yeah, sure, Mad Men, but instead of taking place in an office, it's taking place like in bedrooms. But the
and in some ways probably less interested in class than Mad Men was.
Yeah,
and economics.
Well, yeah. That I guess like that's the interesting thing, because it does feel like Pete and Don Draper. it feels like they're both of a time, but Don Draper's character is drawn looking back, and Pete's character is drawn, you know, from within the time. And I don't know what to take from that, but it feels, it's interesting to me when the, and you know, Mad Men is, you know, a true work of art. Like it's one of the great shows and extraordinarily well written, but it is also doing work from these sort of assumptions about that time that allow us to take a lot of shortcuts, and is, you know, somewhat using like our simplified perceptions of that time, like developed over over the decades that separate us from the 60s. And it's just interesting because like I feel like Pete, I mentioned Horn Dog Foxy. There's something about her letter at the end. It felt of a time, and it felt in alignment with how the time is remembered too. And I don't know where to take that, but it just is interesting.
It's interesting to think about in a relationship. In the questions I sent beforehand, I had mentioned Coming Up for Air by George Orwell, right? Because when we read Bleak House a couple months ago, you know, we talked then about how Bleak House aesthetically, craft-wise, feels astonishingly dated, and Coming Up for Air feels very modern, right? And this is in, I think the Couples is in this odd in-between spot where it, in some ways, it almost feels as dated to me as Bleak House, bizarre as that is to say, right? Like it feels like it so profoundly feels like it was written in 1968. But it's interesting to think about it in relationship to Coming Up for Air, right? Because like both of those are novels that are written on the brink of enormous upheaval, with an understanding that they are on the brink of enormous upheaval, and in some ways probably with a sense of what's coming, but also looking at one side of, you know, an event horizon, right? In the case of Coming Up for Air, that being, you know, writing on the brink of World War II. In the case of this being writing on the brink of what we would now think of as the 60s, right? Because, I mean, this was published in 68, but presumably written in, you know, over a few years prior to 68, and doesn't, you know, the whole kind of idea of what we think of as like the 60s proper, like there's no Vietnam in this, there's no Flower Children, there's no Woodstock. Music is almost totally not really like a presence here, right? So in that way, I think they're very similar novels in that they're like written at the last possible moment before a grand, you know, good or bad, but the last possible moment before essentially kind of an apocalyptic transformation that would make it impossible to make that thing again. And I guess that's as good a place as any to end off. I am looking forward. I actually did repurchase the collected Rabbit omnibus that I mentioned. I'm looking forward to digging into that next time I have a long trip. Any listeners who if from the way we've described this it seems like you would like it, then I'm sure that you would. And if from the way that we've described it it seems loathsome to you, then you will probably hate it. But
right.
And I can imagine lots of people finding, you know, like I can imagine many people I know who are, you know, constant readers finding this deeply alienating for all the reasons that we've talked about.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't fault anybody for like the first time there's like a, you know, a slightly racist or prejudiced description. I wouldn't fault anybody for putting it down at that point.
Or for just finding Pete to be, if you're someone who wants a conventionally likable, admirable protagonist, right, or somebody that you're like rooting for, this is not the book for you.
That's why Megan said she didn't like my novel. Because the convention.
But your novel, certainly there's enormous ironic, right? Like your novel, I think, is very, it's very 2026 in that regard, right?
So I wanted to switch gears a little bit. and I wanted to do some essays. So get yourself a copy, like at the library, of the complete essays of Montaigne. And like that's 1,000 pages. We're not doing that.
I was gonna say, what the fuck, man?
Read book one, which is the first 57 essays.
Jesus.
And that's like less than 300 pages.
Okay.
So that, you know, yeah, book one of the complete essays of Montaigne. And like over chat or something, like I'll send you like an image of the table of contents. So we make sure we're reading the same essays, because different editions might have different essay order. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Is this something where translation is important? Like if you were to send the table of contents and I were to just like Google PDFs, is there?
I'm gonna do the translation by Donald Frame, which was done in the 50s. So if you find that, then we'll all be reading the same one. But I don't know
if my library has the complete essays of Montaigne, but I'll try to make sure we're reading Donald Frame and they are.
I know they're available online. Like I've looked it up.
Yeah, Project Gutenberg.
Yes. So even if you can't get it from the library or whatever, it's available online. Which I know would kind of suck if you had to read it on your computer. But yeah, I really was like, after like novel, like we had all these novels, I was like, I'd really like to go with some essays, and Montaigne as the inventor of the essay felt right.
All right, sounds good. Well, you heard it here first, everybody. 2 weeks to Montaigne, or, you know, give or take, depending how our recording schedule goes. Thank you much, gentlemen, for your time. Glad I had the opportunity to touch back on this work and talk to you about it, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you, guys.
All right. Peace out.
Peace out.